All right, so I'm Heather Whiteman. I have two other presenters who are going to join me, Rachel Cohn and Kit Bodwin, who's here in the front. Rachel actually had a surgery, so she wasn't able to join us, and Kit is here. Raise your hand, Kit. Hi, Kit. And we don't have any disclosures or no relationships to disclose, but again, Rachel was unfortunately had a surgery that she made it difficult for her to move around, and she'd have to elevate her foot with ice, and we were like, oh. So she's sorry she can't be here, but certainly her contact information is available through the PowerPoint, so you can connect with her. And why I say that may be important is because she is the epidemiologist that helped us as a team to identify the model of the community readiness assessment model that I'm going to speak about here today. So you may have more questions around that very specifically, and she might be the one that could answer them better. So assessing community readiness to respond to commercial sexual exploitation, I'll just tell you a small thing about our group and what we'll speak about today. We'll hopefully in the next 15 minutes talk about the community readiness model and how we implemented it here in Massachusetts in two geographic regions of the state, which is Metro West and Central Massachusetts. And our interest was to learn more about how those communities, and I'll describe more when I say those communities, how we're defining community, how those communities are best positioned or positioned at all to effectively respond to commercial sexual exploitation here in the state of Massachusetts, and particularly in Metro West and Central Mass. So for us, we are using the term commercial sexual exploitation, and we're actually using it in the context of understanding the experiences of adults. For us, and as we see here, there's clear divides between when you're speaking about exploitation of children versus adults, it becomes something different. But for us, when children who are being exploited turn 18 and now they're adults, nothing has changed. The exploitation is what it is. The histories are what they are. All of a sudden, you don't become responsible, and now it's your choice for the experiences that that you are unfortunately traumatically bonded to, both your perpetrator, perhaps your buyer, whichever we consider them both perpetrators, your seller and your buyer. And so for us, commercial sexual exploitation is a broad term that we're using to describe all facets of exchanging money, food, shelter, childcare, or any other item of value for sexual-related activities. We consider this as the buying and selling of people for the purposes of sexual gratification of another person. And for us, we actually believe that commercial sexual exploitation can most easily be understood in the context of language and venue. And so we know that exploitation doesn't happen potentially at every strip club, but we know that it happens to a lot of people who are stripping and dancing, and it happens regularly. Another place where commercial sexual exploitation happens is in the creation of pornographic films, those many of which are seen through the internet. We also understand that escort services, call girl services, sex trafficking, sex tourism, these are all places where exploitation happens. We understand prostitution as well as a place where exploitation happens, sexual exploitation. The numbers I won't go through, they're global, and they also are here in the United States, but it's very difficult to count the numbers of people who are being exploited anywhere in the world. People are a transportable commodity. And naturally, again, the role of trauma involved in exploitation is so deep and so complicated that to have someone have to prove force, fraud, and coercion of having to sell their personhood, again, to us isn't fair, and the weight of that responsibility isn't in the right place. So myself and a team of 16 women here in Massachusetts, we are women that either live or work or both in Metro West and Central Mass. We launched a project called Rhea House, and Rhea House stands for Ready, Inspire, Act. This was last year in October. And for us, we were interested in addressing a service gap, as we've just already heard here, that there are limited services across the country for children that are being commercially sexually exploited. And when you become an adult at age 18, if you didn't have any services as a child, you certainly don't have any services as an adult. And so for us, this is a huge service gap. Although there are domestic violence shelters in any state, and certainly in across the state of Massachusetts. Those shelters are limited in their bed capacity. They also, many require you to define an interpersonal relationship that the violence obviously has stemmed from, and often folks that are being sexually exploited don't fit the definitions of ultimately the population that domestic violence shelters are servicing. There's also homeless shelters certainly in any state, and those are equally as complicated. And in either of those shelter situations, naturally services are limited, your stays are short, and often you have to stand outside, you know, before being let in again the next day. So it's just a place where people become re-victimized and certainly can't necessarily move their lives forward or away from the exploitation. So we're interested in creating a home community for adult women. These are adult women who are being commercially sexually exploited, who are being sex trafficked as well. And we started our project by looking at the community readiness model as a potential way to begin to understand how communities, we actually looked at nine population sectors, which I'll go into. But before I describe that, we chose the community readiness model, and I highly recommend that if you're trying to start an initiative and trying to understand better, whether it's a small group of people or a larger group, perhaps an entire state, perhaps an entire city, really consider the community readiness model, because it is a strength-based participatory assessment model. It was developed in the late 90s by a team of researchers at Colorado State University, the Tri-Ethnic Center on Prevention Research. It has over 20 years of research rigor and application to borrow from and to learn from. I really, really recommend it. It also is easy to use, easy to implement. It doesn't cost you anything but your photocopy. You know, photocopying, obviously, the interview tool. It certainly costs you your time in setting up your interviews and obviously creating a list of the people you want to target, et cetera. But it really is so easily implementable. And it takes a public health approach to community change. And in this case, we use the model towards understanding better how a community could respond to, again, commercial sexual exploitation. So what does the model do? It was developed to assess and better understand a community's readiness to both prevent a public health problem while also measuring a community's readiness to mobilize around addressing that same problem. As I said, the model has been used for over 20 years in both national and international settings, so take a look at what's out there because it's very easily accessible and available. So the interview tool is the deliverer or the vehicle of ultimately gathering all this information. And so for the community readiness model, there's six dimensions of questions that ultimately you'll ask any of your whatever group you're ultimately assessing. And these six dimensions of questions are here. It's asking about community efforts, in this case around commercial sexual exploitation is what we were assessing, community knowledge of those efforts, leadership around this public health issue, again, in our case, commercial sexual exploitation, the community climate around the issue, community knowledge about the issue. Do people understand how exploitation affects the individual, the family, the community? They understand the effects of it, the signs, the symptoms. And further, the resources related to this issue. Are there resources available to help somebody if you've identified somebody in need? From answering all those questions, you then are easily walked through scoring each of your interviews. And I can get back to this, but essentially the scoring process puts one interview, so a compilation of all of the questions, it essentially scores someone on a scale of 1 to 9, 9 being that individual has a high level of community ownership over the issue, in this case of commercial sexual exploitation. This means that folks are they're actually implementing programming, evaluating programming, and then using that what they've learned to then restructure programming to make it more effective. So a score of 9 is awesome. A score of 1 naturally is pretty abysmal. So it's no awareness of the issue at all. You're struggling to understand it. You're fighting that it even exists. And if anything, if it exists, it doesn't exist where you are and with the populations that you serve. And then naturally, there's all the iterations between 1 and 9. So what did we do? So the RIA House team, we got to work. So we photocopied tons of those interview sheets which was awesome. And so January through May, we essentially interviewed 88 individuals across 9 population sectors. So we interviewed between 4 and 8 people across any one of those 9 sectors. So that is law enforcement, court, diversion, and legal services, businesses, human services, educators, community residents, government folks, clergy and spiritual leaders, and the health and medical community. How we defined commercial sexual exploitation was, as you see here, in the context, again, in the context of venue, and the language we used was that exploitation includes and is not limited to stripping, pole dancing, lap dancing, massage parlors and saunas, brothels, escort agencies, prostitution, phone sex lines, internet sex chat rooms, pornography, trafficking, forced marriage, mail order brides, and sex tourism. So it was a pretty deep mouthful. And we had people understand this before we actually interviewed them, and they were actually able to read it as part of a privacy statement. And then they agreed naturally to be interviewed. All of our interviews were anonymous. Of our 9 sectors, I will tell you just informally that the legal community and law enforcement were the most difficult to get to agree to be interviewed. And for those that did agree to be interviewed, we were... I don't know how to describe it, but threatened. No, I'm kidding. It wasn't like that. But we were, you know, if anyone finds out I'm being interviewed, Heather, I'm going to be in big trouble. I mean, it's like, okay, but there's no way anyone's going to find out you're being interviewed. So it was really interesting about that. So we coded each of our interview sheets with gender language and then geographic region and then certainly which sector they represented. But there weren't any names on the interview sheets. We didn't need anybody's names. We just need to naturally vouch that they were a real person in this role. And so from there, Metro West here in the state of Massachusetts came in at a stage 2. So across, we did 47 interviews in Metro West. And of all those interviews, the average score came out at a 2, which is denial and resistance. This isn't happening in Metro West. And certainly if it is, it's not our problem. And so there you go. And that, again, is across all 9 sectors, across all 47 people. For Central Massachusetts, they scored just a touch above that. They scored in a stage 3, which is vague awareness. Some people we interviewed knew about this issue, but most didn't. And of the ones that knew something, they certainly weren't sure what to do about it. And I would say that in Central Massachusetts, there is a task force that is organized in the city of Worcester, which is the second largest city in the state, and that task force is charged with working towards eradicating street prostitution. So although Central Mass scored at a stage 3, quite honestly, many of those interviews, because we interviewed a number of people that are on that task force, their interview sheet probably scored a little bit higher because they knew about the task force. So it's a little misleading, but generally speaking, the region was at a stage 3. Outside of the actual score, what we learned in reading through the 88 interviews, and again, each interview had 27 questions across those six dimensions, what was overwhelming in the data, the qualitative data, is that there's a significant lack of public awareness, thank you, across both regions and sectors regarding how commercial exploitation affects the individual, family, and the community. Leadership and funding are hindered because of this. And what that means is in the line of questions around, do you know any leaders that are working on this issue? Do you know where there might be identified grants or other resources that are funding any programs related to helping folks get services, perhaps a law enforcement initiative? And overwhelmingly, the answers were no, no, none, no, none, no. And that, again, is true. From the information, it's fascinating. Thirdly, there's widespread respondent denial that the community is even affected by this problem, and that those are affected. Most importantly, there was the question of whether or not the people, the adults, many of whom are women, are deserving of services. Perhaps no surprise, because the politics around this, as you know, are pretty tremendous, pretty deep. Anyway, so for discussion. So for us, we understood that the next 12 to 18 months and beyond for our team is to create a public awareness campaign in Metro West and Central Mass around this issue, and certainly public awareness campaign across all of those 9 population sectors. Identify our leaders, identify folks that are a little bit higher up on that continuum of readiness, and then really work with them intensely towards helping to get the word out and helping to identify other leaders in the community. And where we want to focus our public awareness campaign are on these 3 particular areas. First and foremost, across all 88 interviews, there was very little, if any, mention about the average age of exposure, introduction, forced entry into the life, which in the United States is between 12 and 15 years old. That's dramatic. No recognition or understanding of that. Also, whether or not exploitation is happening here in our backyards, no understanding of that. And fourth, choice and the role of violence in exploitation. Across 88 interviews, we had 2 mentions of the role of violence. One was by a clergy member who mentioned that an obstacle to working on this issue is demand. You'll never be able to overcome demand. That was one person. Only mention of demand across all of the interviews. On the other end, we had one person in the human service sector that identified the role of the pimp in this exploitive relationship. Other than that, there was no understanding of the role of violence, no understanding of the role of sexual assault and rape, no understanding of the traumatic bonding that happens, both physical and psychological, and that is happening at a very young age, and then folks are growing up with the shame and the dehumanization and the weight, really the weight of all of us. There's no understanding of that at all. So for us, a public awareness campaign has to involve all 3 of those things. For our next steps, we are actually hosting an awareness event next week, which we're very excited about. We're identifying local leaders that we've invited to this event. We hope that some of them come, some of the people we interviewed. And furthermore, creating partnerships that we've already started to do with some of the sort of low-hanging fruit, the rape crisis centers, for example, domestic violence shelters, some of the human service providers that are best sort of poised to become our natural partners at this early stage. And then helping us to develop trauma-informed programs, we're trying to identify an institutional partner, a university college here in the state of Massachusetts that might work with us to develop a trauma-informed needs assessment of adult women here in the state to understand better what their needs are, what they're interested in, how could we help them move their lives forward and reintegrate well into the community. The limitations to our research is in that broad definition that I labored to read to you intentionally, but that confused some of our respondents because it was just too much to think about. You want me to think about human trafficking while I'm also thinking of pornography and prostitution, so it was just a little overwhelming for them and something we would reconsider if we did this again. Another thing is conducting the interviews. We probably could have benefited from more training of our interviewers, more training around how to help encourage people to answer more than just, no, I don't know, never heard of this, that type of thing. So that would have been really beneficial to our information. And lastly, more than 2/3 of our respondents were females across all the sectors. And this was one exception was law enforcement, which was almost entirely males. And of this, most all of our interviewers were women. And so we're not sure how that would have impacted our findings. Our thought is that we would learn that there's even less awareness, but I'm not sure. So we don't know that. Otherwise, thank you. Our website is there listed. Please, you know, look to that for more information about this process. Our paper, we also have written a paper about all of our findings in great detail. So I really, you know, recommend that you go and take a look at it. It's really interesting. Thank you.